It's the Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. Could we talk about real-world kitchens, as in working with what we've got? Because if you watch those home shows, it seems that you can't microwave a pizza unless your kitchen's 20 by 20 with granite countertops and stainless steel appliances. Look, that's lovely, but shiny granite scratches and breaks things and needs resealing, and stainless doesn't stay stainless for very long. And who needs a cavernous kitchen that's going to bankrupt you? Well, today we look at the genius of small, as in kitchens. We talk with you and we get into much more. That's this hour on The Splendid Table.
This week's Splendid Table is a repeat of an earlier broadcast.
This is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media, the show about life's appetites. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. Well, today we're looking at things through the story of someone else. For instance, when a journalist has been living a story since childhood and then digs into it as a professional, you get a kind of depth and understanding that keeps you reading page to page. Now, in this case, the child is Paul Greenberg. He fished the ponds of his mother's rented cottages in Connecticut, and as the fish ran out, he followed them to the river and then to the shore of the Atlantic. And eventually he followed the fish to the deepest seas. Well, that's how his book on what's happening to our last wild food came to be. Paul Greenberg has written For Fish, The Future of the Last Wild Food. Paul, welcome.
Thanks for having me, Lynn.
So, Paul, For Fish, which four and why only four?
Well, the four fish, first of all, are salmon, sea bass, cod, and tuna. And when I chose those four fish, I really wanted to look at the problems of the sea in the way that the consumer confronted them. There have been many books about the end of the ocean or the problems with fishing and all of
that.
But I think the average consumer kind of finds it kind of confusing. And so what I really wanted to do was to look at four fish that were very, very common in the marketplace and to follow those fish both in and out of domestication, because all of them are being domesticated in some way or another.
Hmm. All right. Let's pick one of those fish as an example to give us sort of the highlights of what you learned in. Since bluefin tuna, you know, is the darling of every sushi chef and every sushi lover, let's talk about the bluefin tuna.
Yeah. Well, first of all, there's three species of bluefin tuna out there. There's an Atlantic, a Pacific, and a Southern. But the one that everyone is concerned about right now is the Atlantic bluefin. And this is an amazing fish. This fish swims at 40 miles an hour. It crosses the Atlantic. It can be over 1,000 pounds, over 15 feet. It's a huge, huge fish.
15 feet? That's a bedroom.
Yep, I know. And another interesting fact about them is that they're warm-blooded. I think a lot of people think of fish as these sort of, you know, the expression cold fish.
Yeah,
but
exactly.
This is, in fact, a warm fish. And in certain cases, when you bring them out of the water, when you put your hand on their flank, you can actually feel the warmth coming off their body.
Oh.
So it's an incredible fish. And for those of us who've seen them and held them, they really feel much more like wildlife than food. And, you know, once upon a time, bluefin were despised even by the Japanese as table fare. The nickname that sushi chefs gave to bluefin was chibi, or means 4 days, because Japanese sushi chefs, when they first started using bluefin, would bury them in the ground for 4 days to get rid of that, like, bloody metallic taste.
Uh-huh.
So, you know, that said, over the years, the Japanese grew to appreciate bluefin, mostly because during the American occupation, they were exposed to high-fat foods like beef, and they sort of that sort of translated into this very fatty bluefin. It's really the fat content that makes bluefin particularly appealing on the palate. And oftentimes with a lot of fish, it's fat content. Bluefin are extremely rich, particularly the otoro, which is this sort of ventral, you know, chunk of fish.
It's the belly,
flesh,
isn't it?
Near the belly, exactly.
Yeah, it's the belly.
And so that's become, you know, really, really, you know, appreciated and loved. But I also think, you know, there's a certain class of people out there who just want the best, no matter what it does to the world. You know, it's those people who want to drive a Hummer, even though they know they're getting whatever 5 miles to the gallon or 10 miles, whatever it is. And so there are these people out there, you know, it's become ensconced that bluefin is the best. And I think our fetish of this fish has really just gotten out of control.
You know, going back, I don't think we realize that fish are wild.
It's true. And even if you look at the word seafood, you know, I mean, it's kind of a disgusting word when you think of it. I mean, we don't call everything from the land, we don't call it land food. But seafood is this sort of kind of catch-all word that we use to just pull out whatever we want and turn it into food. But, you know, the thing is, one of the reasons I think we don't recognize it as wildlife is that there's still a lot of fish in the sea. I mean, we take 170 million or billion pounds, sorry, of fish out of the oceans every year, which is, you know, the equivalent to the human weight of the population of China. We take that out every year. So it's not like we're dealing with buffalo or tigers or lions in terms of raw numbers. There's still a lot of fish out there. And so we haven't gotten to this point of extreme scarcity that we have to start thinking about it as wildlife. And I think in a way, abundance and or scarcity is linked to the word wildlife. Something has to get scarce in us for us to go like slap ourselves in the forehead and go, duh, oh my God, it was wildlife and we ate it all. So, I mean, I think what I'd like to see happen with fish is that we realize it's wildlife before we eat it into a situation of scarcity. And I actually think for even for the bluefin, for the Atlantic bluefin, that there's still a chance to do that.
So the other fish that you selected, for instance, cod, what is the story behind cod? Isn't it endangered at this point?
It isn't. It isn't endangered in the sense of, you know, you can never talk about a single species in the way that you talk about, say, I don't know, California condors. Because with fish, they're still so numerous that there are these separate populations, or what they call stocks of cod around the world,
right,
that function like sort of nations. They have independent ecological economies. You know, there's several cod stocks that go up and down the American and Canadian coasts. They're all severely depleted, but some of them are rebuilding. In particular, the Gulf of Maine cod stock is now, according to Marine Fisheries, is 50% rebuilt. But taking another step back and unpacking that endangerment further, we have to always look back at history and what we had and what we lost. You know, the amount of sheer just abundance of cod that was out there is just astounding. I mean, there was, as recently as the 1960s, 2 billion codfish off the coasts of Atlantic Canada. And now we're talking at probably numbers in the you know, low millions to hundreds of thousands. So you could say to somebody, you know, got a million codfish out there, that's pretty good. But compared to 2 billion, you know,
that's not a lot. Yeah.
It's several orders of magnitude. And it's that abundance thing that we really want to focus in on and try and restore to our oceans. You know, what cod really represent is the industrialization of fishing. Before we found cod, fishing was really much more just of a hook and line endeavor. Mm. Cod, though, because they have these huge aggregations, really prompted us to kind of ramp up our what's called industrial fishing. Huge bottom trawlers that tear up the bottom. Just massive, massive fishing effort. And I think it's really with cod that we need to start backing away from that industrial effort. As some of these codfish populations rebuild, we need to think, you know, what we need are kind of ecologist fishermen. I call them herder fishermen, in the sense that they need to feel intimately related to their particular stock of fish and feel both responsible for the catching of them and for the preserving of them. And if we can get to that place, I think that there's a hope for fish as food.
Mm-hmm. Well, Paul, thank you.
Thank you, Lynn.
Paul Greenberg is author of Four Fish, The Future of the Last Wild Food. Just as the state of the oceans is influencing what we buy, the rise of the Hispanic population is bringing us all kinds of new tastes. I mean, not only are tortillas and chicharrones and dulce de leche available in nearly every grocery store from Maine to Alaska, those Latin flavors are influencing some American classics that one would have considered basically untouchable. Move over, Bomb Pops. Lisa Morehouse has the story.
Open the door of a small storefront in Durham, North Carolina, and you're in a frozen treat heaven called Loco Pops.
They're sort of like popsicles, except there's more flavors like strawberries and cream, Mexican chocolate, cookies and cream, and chocolate brownie.
On this side, we have our water-based ones. These are more like sorbet. We have mojito, which is mint and lime, pomegranate tangerine, a little tart, cherry lime.
It is a local business that started small. The person who started it put a lot of research into it and actually went and practiced in Mexico, where this is more of an art.
That story of owner Summer Bicknell is familiar to many customers. For years, Bicknell was a corporate drone working too many hours in dissatisfying jobs. Her last job title was a mouthful, Director of Clinical Information Systems Design.
Which was such a long title that it rapped on the business card, which I think is kind of silly.
A chance visit with a friend to a paleteria, a Mexican popsicle shop, changed everything.
He looked at me and said, I bet you could learn how to make these. And that was a Saturday, and Monday I went in and quit my job. I guess, you know, on the one hand you could say, what a wackadoo. And on the other hand, you could say, you know, just the right piece of information at just the right time.
Bicknell sold her house and moved from Nashville to Michoacan, Mexico to study at the elbow of a master paleta maker. She spent 3 months there trying to take copious notes.
She would do these kind of rapid things, and I would try to take as many notes as I could, and then I'd have to taste it. I had to learn by my senses as opposed to any kind of formal education.
On another whim, she relocated to Durham and set up shop. Her parents thought the whole endeavor was crazy, loco, hence the business name. But she clearly wasn't that crazy. Now she has 3 stores and kiosks on the Duke and University of North Carolina campuses. But Bicknell's turned down all offers to franchise, preferring to stay hands-on.
I always want to be able to go lay hands on my children, my little frozen children.
I got Mighty Mojito because it's really hot outside and I want something refreshing.
I got Mango Chile because it reminds me of Mexico.
Bicknell always includes Mexican-inspired flavors on the menu. But she adjusts the traditional paleta's sweetness and artificial colors for the American palate. And she gets inspiration from all over the world. One time, a Duke student of Indian origin brought her whole extended family to Loco Pops.
Her mother lingered at the counter and chatted with me for a little while, and I just said, you know, what kind of desserts do you have in India? And she went on and listed this whole list of flavor combinations that I was not familiar with and that I had never really experimented with. And I thought, well, that's great. I've got another 3 months of work to do just from this one conversation. This is wonderful.
Bicknell added pistachio rose water, mango lassi, and cardamom chocolate brownie to her stable of flavors. She also gets ideas closer to home.
If you have ideas for flavors and you really want that flavor and they don't have it, then you can write it down and put it in the mailbox and maybe they'll have it.
I put in a request just last week for something coconut. And so I'm having a coconut mango today. So I don't know if it's the results of my note, but I can hope so. I am feeling cared for, yes.
As opposed to her prior career, Bicknell now gets all the positive feedback she can stand.
People come into the store, they're already excited to be there, they leave even happier. Who wouldn't want a job like that, really? My business is pleasing people. It's a wonderful way to make a living. I can't get over that part of it. I really can't.
Enjoy.
Thank you. Lisa Morehouse is an independent producer living in San Francisco. Well, we found a recipe inspired by those Loco Pops. The writer J.J. Good created it in an article in Details magazine. Now, you can find J.J.'s recipe for raspberry coconut pops right on the website, splendidtable.org. Now, we're going to be back in a minute with therapy for the minuscule apartment kitchen and wondrous things to do with a bottle of beer. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. This is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media, the show for people who love to eat. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. Willoughby's high on the list of food people to check in with to see what they're up to. He's got books that rack up awards, and he's always digging into new territory. Hey, John, it's good to have you back.
It's great to be back.
So what are you working on?
Well, recently I've been cooking with stout, which is, you know, what I'm always looking for when I cook is something that you can add to food that gives you a lot of complex flavors mm-hmm. all by itself, so you get a lot of bang for the buck. And stout is one of those ingredients. It's a type of beer made with roasted barley or roasted barley malt. So it's dark, a dark beer. And the one people know best is Guinness. So,
right.
You know, when you pour
yeah.
the Guinness, it's kind of dense. It's got that beautiful head of that looks like a crema on an espresso.
Mm-hmm.
And it's got some chocolate, some coffee, a little bit of smoke. It's got a lot of intense flavors. So stout is a great thing to cook with. And there are all kinds of stouts. There are, in the state of Michigan, there are 40 brands of stout
You're
alone.
You're kidding.
So, no.
40?
It's one of the 40 different brands because it's, you know, the artisanal brewers love stout because it's very interesting and it's a fun thing to play with. Stout has sort of gone out of favor by the 20th century. Guinness was really the only one you saw. But since the 1970s and all the increase in artisanal brewers, you now find it all over the place in many different varieties. So there's chocolate stout, there's oatmeal stout, there's milk stout, and they all do have certain subtle differences. But for cooking, you can use any one of them.
This means that they might be good with those foods, or is it that is there an element of those foods in them?
Well,
or is it just a name?
For example, the chocolate stout is partially for the color, but it also has a more of a chocolatey flavor because they use really dark roasted malt.
Uh-huh.
Some brewers have even put a little chocolate in it, but I think that's mostly a stunt. But stout has always been used since the 18th century in England along with chocolate. So for desserts like a stout cake or stout brownies,
yeah.
It's a great ingredient. And it's also, you know, the most popular stout, Guinness, obviously, is Irish. So it's been used a lot with lamb. It goes great with lamb stew or lamb shank as a braising liquid. It's also a good braising liquid for just about any kind of red meat. So those are really easy and traditional ways of using it. And they're also, you know, as you experiment with it, as usual, you find all kinds of things you can do with it. If you are making something with a batter like fried onion rings, and mm-hmm. often it uses a lager beer. If you put the stout in instead, it really deepens and enriches the flavor. Mm-hmm. So whenever you're cooking with beer, try stout, and it's probably going to be a little more interesting, a little richer, and a little better.
So what's turning you on now with the stout?
Well,
are you doing?
Well, as usual, I'm looking for things to do that are a little unusual. So I found that if you take the stout and reduce it down with some balsamic vinegar, a little lemon juice and lemon rind and some salt and pepper, if you reduce it down from about a cup of stout to a few tablespoons of stout, what you get is this intensely flavored glaze, which is, I love it on lamb chops. It's great with the lamb roast. It's also great on pork. So, you know, it's just as usual. You put a little bit of it on when you start cooking. And if you're grilling, you sort of wait till the end to put it on. But if you're roasting, you can sort of drizzle the glaze on throughout the time that you're roasting. And you get this meat, which has got all those chocolate, toasty, roasty sort of coffee flavors from the stout, with very little work on your part. And so it has a complex flavor. It's great. And it's a little unusual because I don't think people have done this much.
This sounds fabulous.
Yeah.
John, thank you.
My pleasure, Lynn.
John Willoughby's story on stout appeared in the New York Times. Now, you get yourself a bottle of stout, and then you try John's recipe for stout citrus glaze. It's on the website, splendidtable.org. Good food for reasonable cash, which takes me to Jane and Michael Stern, who hunt down such gems for their road food site, and to share with us. Jane, Michael, what's the find this week?
Hi, Lynn.
Hi, Lynn.
We've been to the most beautiful place in all of the United States, Cannon Beach, Oregon.
Oh, my.
Have you ever been there?
No, no.
Oh, it's supernatural. This is very near where James Beard grew up, and you know where I'm talking about.
Yeah, yeah. It's the Oregon coast, and it's seaside Oregon.
Exactly. But Cannon Beach has these rocks that stick up out of the ocean, and at sunset, everything turns pink and orange, and It's almost beautiful enough to make us not think of what we're going to eat next, but not quite that beautiful. So I'm happy to tell you about a place that we found called Waves of Grain in Cannon Beach, Oregon.
And it's Waves of Grain, as you might suspect from the name, is a bakery. And frankly, I don't know too many bakeries where the proprietor's family grows the wheat from which the breads and pastries are made.
Huh.
But that is the case at Waves of Grain.
Uh-huh.
The family of Jason and Hillary Fargo, who run the place, have farms out in the eastern part of Oregon, you know, which is beautiful in its own way. I mean, that
it's
is
very
the,
dry. It's wheat country, essentially.
It's wheat country.
Country.
And, you know, that is where, you know, waving
amber waves of grain.
I mean, there they are. And that's where they get the wheat for incredibly good pastries. I mean, really some of the most delicious, you know, breads, muffins, sticky buns.
You know what my absolute favorite thing was? From their own wheat and from the local Tillamook cheese, they make just a big creamy biscuit. And that with espresso for breakfast, looking over these pink and orange rocks is probably the most ethereal experience I've had.
This really sounds spectacular.
It's heavenly.
It's worth a trip. It truly is.
And, I mean, do you just eat those things there or do they have food? You know what I'm saying? Can you have a sandwich? Yeah. Can you have, you know, something like that?
They don't make sandwiches, but they do have, you know, focaccias and quiches and sort of bakery
sticky
things
buns
that could kind of pass as a lunch. But for us, it's such a great place to have breakfast because of the locally brewed coffee.
And also the chocolate buttermilk cupcakes were beyond good.
Yes.
I mean, I've said, you know, everybody's a locavore these days. And, you know, I grow my own tomatoes and I, you know, get my own beans out of the garden. But few people grow their own wheat.
Yeah.
So I thought this was very impressive.
Who's doing the baking?
Jason and Hillary, who run the place.
I think that their cousin Fritz Hill grows
yes,
the wheat.
Yes, and he's the fourth generation guy to be doing this, so I guess he knows what he's doing.
Sounds like a great operation. Hey, guys, thank you.
Bye, Lynn.
Bye, Lynn.
Jane and Michael Stern's latest work is 500 Things to Eat Before It's Too Late. Their finds are on the site, splendidtable.org. Now, the baking season has officially opened, and you can bake your own loaf. Find the recipe for 5-minute artisan bread on that site, splendidtable.org. Realtors want us to think big. I mean, check out the house hunting shows. Humongous kitchens and formal dining rooms, by the way, which you use maybe 2 or 3 times a year. Well, what happened to saving money by making small spaces an asset? There's a designer who goes that route. He likes small. Maxwell Gillingham Ryan is the mind behind the apartment therapy site and is the author of Apartment Therapy's Big Book of Small Cool Spaces. Maxwell, welcome.
Thank you, Lynn.
What are the tricks in working with small?
Well, the thing to realize about your space is that you don't get a sense for your space as being big or little because you walk around and actually rub against all the walls and say, boy, my space feels big today or small. Your eye is the thing that travels through your space. You really want to design for the eye. You want to make the eye able to move through the space and not get stuck on lots of stuff. And there's lots of tricks, really, in a way, for moving the eye around your space.
So, for instance, when you have a tiny space, you may have a little kitchen, but one of the things is you want to entertain, and there's usually not much space for that. So how do you apply this idea?
Well, it's so funny. I'm from New York City, and people crowd into these tiny little restaurants and sit at these tiny little tables and love it. And so I've never thought that you need a lot of space to have a great meal or feel really cozy with your guests. What you need to do is you need to at least have a space to sit down. And some of the tricks are having the dining room close to the kitchen. If you can sort of join it to the kitchen, it makes it a very attractive space, a space you'll use more often. And then the other big thing you need to do in your dining area is light it well. We love restaurants largely because they're well lit. I tell people to get at least 3 points of light into their dining room. For example, like in our small dining room, which is right off of our kitchen, we have a round table. And we usually sit at it. There's usually two or three of us most of the time. I put a table lamp right on the dining table against the wall. Mm-hmm. And then behind the table lamp, we have a nice big mirror. That amplifies the light. And then we do have an overhead light that we have on a dimmer. Again, it's all about letting the eye roam, and mirrors and light open up a space.
Right.
Another great way to give the sense of a lot more space and brighten up and open up your kitchen is to mirror the back of your kitchen cabinets. Usually they're dark spaces. You can lose things back there and they suck in the light. But when you mirror them, you have the sense on opening the doors of brightness and being able to see everything inside. I've seen it done a number of times, and it's a remarkable way of opening up what is typically a dark part of the kitchen.
It's a dynamite idea. What happens when you don't have a dining room? I mean, are there sneaky ways, for instance, to turn one part of the apartment into a dining area and then it goes back to being something else?
Yes. To create more dining space, use console tables, which normally might be living up against the wall or behind a sofa. They're perfect height. You can pull them out. You can put two together, in fact, to make a long table. And you have a nice supply of slim folding chairs, and you can make dinners up to 8-10 people, after which you fold the chairs up and you slide them back into place and they disappear into the room.
It's a dynamite idea. Maxwell, thank you.
Thank you, Lynn.
Maxwell Gillingham Ryan's book is Apartment Therapy's Big Book of Small, Cool Spaces. Okay, let's you and me talk. The lines are open. Call us 800-537-5252 or shoot us an email. Go to splendidtable.org. Let's see. Anything goes. Cindy from Rochester, New York is calling. Cindy, what do you want to talk about?
Hi, Lynn. My question is about how to achieve heat in my cooking. My fiancé's from New Orleans, and I just can't seem to make my food spicy enough for him. He's a junkie when it comes to the stuff.
Do you know, I have a theory, by the way, that chilies can be addictive. This is my theory.
Well, I'm going to tell him that.
Okay, here's the deal. Well, what are you using now?
Well, that's the problem. We have quite a variety of dried chilies, spices, any spice you can think of. We often get fresh peppers, jalapenos, and I just don't know maybe how to mix and match or how to achieve that intensity without killing
it. A few, yeah, well, killing it would be habanero chilies.
Okay.
Yeah, that's about as hot as it's going to get. And, you know, I think the key to eating a chili is that it has flavor. And if it's so hot you can't taste the chili, you know, then you've defeated the purpose. But there is something called a Scoville scale, which you can look up on the web, and it will tell you the heat of chili. So the most mild ones are generally things like jalapenos, which can still be pretty hot. Ancho chili is quite mild. For flavor, this is what I love. Ancho chilies, which are a dried red chili, and it comes ground or not because they're velvety and sweet and not terribly hot. Now, you can mix ancho chilies with cayenne chili, which for my money is very hot, but it's not huge on flavor, okay? And you'll get the velvety sweetness of one chili, and you'll get the punch of the other. Another chili that is utterly fabulous, I've been addicted to this stuff for a couple of years now, is Aleppo chili. It's from Aleppo. It's a city in the Middle East, and originally it comes from there. It's now grown all over, and it's dried, and it comes coarse ground. And the very best place to go for it is Penzi's. They're online, and it's really worth the mail order. And this is a chili with a bit of sparkle and heat, but it's deeply fruity.
Okay.
It is just delicious on its own.
Wow.
Yeah. Now,
I have never heard of it. Could you spell it for me?
A-L-E-P-P-O, if I remember correctly.
Okay.
Aleppo. And Penzi's is online. You know, it's a spice company, and they have very decent spices. And normally I'd say, you know, go to the store or whatever. But I think this is a case where one company does a superior job. Mm-hmm. Now, when you use the very common available ones like jalapeno and serrano, serrano is hotter than jalapeno, okay?
Mm-hmm.
But both of them share something similar. They have very citrusy tastes to them.
Okay.
You know, so if you're doing something with lemon and with lime and that kind of thing, you want a jalapeno or you want a serrano. And they're going to be pretty hot. And if he wants it hotter, look at the Scoville scale. And that's going to tell you how many units each chili has. So, you know, if a chili has 100 units, it's really mild. If a chili has 250,000 units, which I think is something like the habanero, that's where the top of your head comes off.
Okay.
Okay.
And this is helpful because I don't like it that hot, but he certainly does.
Well, let me tell you something else about this, because I was married to a man who didn't like chilies, and I'm still married to the same guy, and now he craves them. You can gradually develop a tolerance for them.
Mm.
And when you start really liking them a lot, and I'm not saying hotter is better, but if you start eating more mild ones and then a little hotter and a little hotter, you'll find that you'll be more tolerant of them in most cases.
Uh-huh.
But no doubt, whatever you do is going to make him happy, so you're home free.
Exactly.
Hey, Cindy, thank you.
Thanks so much, Lynn.
You are welcome.
Bye-bye.
Take care. You can reach us, friend us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, shoot us an email, splendidtable.org, or call us, 800-537-5252. It is time for our weekly trivia challenge. Now, the question is, what is the most important decision to make when you buy a new toaster? All right, start pondering. We're going to be back with that answer in a moment, and we're going to be talking with you. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. This is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media, the show for people who love to eat. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. Now, we're going to be talking to you in a moment. You can join us at 800-537-5252. Connect with us on Facebook. Follow us on Twitter. But first, I've got the answer to this week's trivia challenge. Now, the question was, what is the most important decision to make when you buy a new toaster? Well, if you're a follower of the wacky and the original, you have to decide between the Jesus toaster, the peace toaster, and the pot toaster. Now, these are toasters that actually burn a design into your morning toast. Now, the options are a cannabis leaf, a peace sign, or Jesus complete with a halo and radiating rays of light. Galen Dively III is the man behind the toasters. He calls his company Burnt Offerings. And what could be better than your kids unpacking their PB&J with a peace sign emblazoned across the bread? Okay, back to your calls. Let's talk. You can reach us at 800-537-5252 or check us out on Facebook. We've got Andy calling from Minneapolis. Andy, what do you want to talk about?
Hey, Lynn, I kind of have a philosophical, gastronomical question.
Oh, you've got my attention.
Why are people so resistant to combine different flavors?
Well, first of all, I debate whether we're resistant. I think tastes are often dictated by the environment we're in.
Mm-hmm.
You know, whether it's how we're raised or just what people around us eat.
Right.
And that's where you get kids who say, ick, I never eat that. Well, they've never tasted it, or
right.
they've seen that reaction from their parents.
Right.
Or it's deemed to be foreign or something in quotes, we do not eat. And I think a lot of that's cultural and emotional.
Right.
And you know what the other thing is? Some of the great ideas for unusual combinations come from looking at the traditional foods of other countries.
Right.
I mean, you look at chocolate and turkey, right? Chocolate with chilies and nuts and oregano and whatever. In Mexico, it's called a mole.
Right.
And there are, I mean, another way to look at it is there are flavors that generally don't work together. A lot of it's subjective.
Right.
I discovered the hard way dill and tarragon kill each other. Because they're both sweet, kind of, and the anise quality of the tarragon really comes out, and it's really not a pleasant combination.
Right. See, and I would love to see some of those herbs in either chocolate or ice cream or something like that in a dessert. I think it would be great.
And I think it's happening. You know, people are experimenting. And if you think about it, anything creamy and fatty, that will generally take to seasonings. You know, I came to the conclusion a while ago that the sort of center of where all seasonings come from, you know, in terms of possible combinations, that core consists of four possible things you begin with: sugar or salt or acids or fat. If you start with ice cream, which is fat and it's sugar at the same time, I'd melt down a little bit of, you know, a good vanilla ice cream and mix in some fresh dill.
Yeah, right.
And see, you know the other thing you want to try? Melt down the vanilla ice cream, puree a really good avocado with a lot of fresh lime in it, and puree with it a jalapeno chili.
Ooh.
Fold that into the ice cream and refreeze it. It will make you want to weep with joy.
See, that would be great.
Yeah, that would be fabulous. Give it a shot.
Yeah,
see what you think.
I'll try.
I love that combination.
Great.
It's just fabulous.
Absolutely. Thanks, Lynn.
Thank you, Andy. You take care.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Bye. You can call us 800-537-5252. Let's see who's on the line. Vicky's calling from Fort Collins, Colorado. Vicky, what's up? What do you want to talk about?
Hello, Lynn.
Hi.
I am calling to ask you about Italian wines. I had the great fortune of living in Italy for a year, and one of the things I liked there was that in the summertime, they would serve a red wine that was a very light red wine. It was not, you know, it wasn't a typical red wine like we get in the U.S. It's really, you know, heavy, full-bodied, et cetera. But it was definitely a red wine, not a rosé, and they would serve it slightly chilled, which was just, you know, a really great summer alternative to a white wine when it's hot outside.
Right.
And I have not been able to find an equivalent here in the U.S. as far as, you know, I've talked to people at liquor stores and they kind of go, huh.
Where were you in Italy?
In Rome.
Okay. There's lots of possibilities because there are, you know, I mean, Italy. My gosh, the number of different wines. But, you know, this, first of all, there's one thing, and it's interesting, too, because I hear this all the time from wine people we talk to about lightly chilling red wines.
Yeah.
Because ideally you want them at about 50 degrees, but in the summer, it's not a bad thing to bring them down even further.
Yeah.
And it's so refreshing, isn't it? I mean,
absolutely.
Okay. Well, there's a bunch of wines you might want to try.
Okay.
As far as – now, Rome is in the Lazio region, and I'm drawing – I mean, as far as red wines, I've just drawn a complete blank. But you have wines that you're going to find in every wine shop practically – from other parts of Italy that I think you might really want to try. First of all, one is Valpolicella. That's up near Venice, okay? And it's very light body, tends to have a bit of acid to it, which is really good with summer food.
Okay.
You know, you want something that's a bit acidic and that kind of thing. Bardolino is another one.
Okay.
And then one of them that more and more we're seeing the really good stuff come in is Lambrusco.
Oh, okay.
Now,
yeah.
Lambrusco, you know, got a bad reputation as being like soda pop. Well, if you've ever drunk Lambrusco in the Emilia-Romagna region where it's made, it's dry and crisp and it's on the light side and it's sparkling and it's really refreshing. And it's also, it's always eaten with the, you know, with things, rich things.
Okay.
And then there's a wine from the Piedmont that I think is starting to come in, and it was a, it's a wine that I used to drink a lot there. And it's called Frasia.
Okay.
And this is a light-bodied red, and it's also can be fizzy.
Okay, so it can either be, yeah, with or without the carbonate. Okay.
Yeah, yeah, and I have to say, any one of those wines, lightly chilled or really chilled,
yeah,
you know, the sparkling wines, you tend to really kind of bring down even further than 50 degrees. Really delicious. And you're going to find, you know, some of those you're going to find. Bardolino and Valpolicella are a cinch. You'll find those.
Okay. Those will be easy to find.
Those will be fabulously easy to find.
Okay.
Okay? And you know the other thing to think about? I've realized it has nothing to do with Italy. But hard ciders, because they're about 6% alcohol.
Yep.
And there's really dry ciders from Asturias in northern Spain.
Uh-huh.
And then the great cider maker in France is Eric Beaudelet, or Bordelais.
Okay.
And he does a dry and a slightly sweet, and the slightly sweet is not cloying.
Yeah.
And he does pear and he does apple. And those ciders are, you just quaff them.
Oh, excellent.
So
excellent.
Just, you know, on its side. It's not Italian.
Yeah.
But
yeah, that's okay.
Thank you for calling.
Thank you very much. I will go look for these.
Have fun, Vicki.
All right, thanks.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
You can get to us by phone, 800-537-5252, or go to Facebook or online, splendidtable.org. Shoot us an email. We've got Deidre on the line from Akron, Ohio. Deidre, what do you want to talk about?
I was going to talk about my seed story that I had sent into your site.
What was the story?
I was student teaching first grade at an inner city school in Akron, and I read Jack and the Beanstalk to the children.
Right.
And then I had them each plant bean seeds, and we had styrofoam cups in the soil in there, and I wrote their names on the outside of each of the cups, and every morning they all came running in to see if their seed had come up.
Oh, yeah.
And there was one little boy, it didn't come up. Every day he'd say, Mrs. Betancourt, my seed's not up. So after a couple weeks, I decided that I'd take one of the extra cups that I'd put in the back and put his name on it because they had sprouted. I just thought in case some of them didn't. And I stuck it out front, and he came in. It was the first things the kids looked at in the morning when they came into the classroom. And he went, Mrs. Betancourt, it's a miracle. It's a miracle. And I walked over and looked at the cup with him, and I said, it is a miracle, isn't it, Anthony? He goes, it's a miracle. I ate that seed, and it's still coming up. I didn't know what to say.
I haven't read all the seed stories, and I missed this one. Oh, that's wonderful.
It was cute.
And you realize the faith that kid now has. What do you want to bet that kid's now a great gardener?
Oh, I hope so.
Deidre, thank you so much.
You're welcome. And you thank you.
Oh, you take care.
All right. Bye-bye.
Goodbye. Oh, that's wonderful. Do tell us your seed stories. Go online, splendidtable.org, and take a look. And just read them. They're great fun. Well, you can reach us, 800-537-5252, or on that website, or go to our Facebook page. Brenda's on the line from Tulsa. Brenda, hi, what do you want to talk about?
I want to talk about bubble tea. I was in at the farmer's market, and there was a couple there making bubble tea, and I had never heard of it. And so the man described it a little bit to me, and when he made it, the tapioca pearls were black. And what I'm used to seeing is tapioca pearls that are white.
Right.
And so my question is, where do you find the tapioca pearls? Does it matter what kind you use, black or white? And if there's a special kind of tea that they use? It was delicious. It was real unique. I just would like to try and create it at home.
Well, it's a big thing in much of Asia because you find it in Japan and in China. And it's something, you know how each culture has a different predilection for certain things?
Sure.
You know, the things that someone is not in the culture would look at and say, why? And yet to you, it's just fabulous. Well, this gelatinous quality is really something that's very, very appealing in a lot of Asia. And I don't think it's going to make a huge difference. I know black tapioca exists, and you'd probably find it in Asian markets.
Okay.
And definitely online.
We have a good one here.
Yeah. And you could ask, you know, do they carry it? But I don't think it's going to make a huge difference. Usually the tea that's used is a green tea. And the lovely thing about green tea is that it is so delicious on its own cold, and it can taste a little bit almost like toasted barley. But what happens with a lot of the bubble teas is that so many other things are added to it, the green tea just becomes a carrier. You know, there's
right,
so many.
They had fruit flavor in this.
Yeah. And so, you know, I mean, you could make it, you know, there are fruit teas now all over the place where the essence of the fruit has gone into the tea, not necessarily the sweetness of the fruit. But you could start with one of those, whether it's a black tea or a green tea. But another nice thing is that you could make the green tea and steep it with some of the crushed fruit and then just strain it.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
And that, I mean, that's doing the real homemade version of it. But check out the black tapioca. I mean, if you can, do a comparison. I've never had a chance to do it. I think it'd be really dramatic to see black tapioca floating around in the glass. It would be gorgeous.
It's either dramatic or gross, depending on how you look at it.
Hey,
I'll let you know if I find out.
All right, please do.
Okay.
It'd be great to know.
Thanks, hey, Lynn.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye. Call us, 800-537-5252, or go online, splendidtable.org. Amelia Morris blogs on food, but in a particular way that I don't think won the hearts and minds of some food companies and food editors. Well, she's here to tell us about it. Amelia, welcome. Good to talk to you.
No, thank you so much. I'm very happy to be here.
Okay, you've got to explain your blog. Explain what it's about.
Well, it all happened pretty organically. I didn't set out to start a food blog. I set out to make this the cover recipe of Bon Appetit's December issue. Bon Appetit.
Don't worry, there'll probably be a Bon Appetit magazine soon. So you started out to recreate the cover recipe.
Yes. Yes. It was this chocolate layer cake. It had chocolate cake. There was a white chocolate cream, whipped cream. There was a ganache. And my husband and I were having people over for Christmas. And we almost had it. Like, it was 2 days in the making. I had had all the elements. We just had to put it together. And it just started sliding. Like, we were just in shock and awe. And so we were taking pictures of it the whole time. And it just totally fell. And people were coming over. So we just scooped it into a bowl. And it was hilarious, but it was also like, I can't believe that happened. And so then I just got the idea that this is what I could do. I could just try these crazy recipes, and I would be like the real world version, and I would be like, you know, the stars without makeup.
Yes, yes. So you started then tracking down photographs from magazines and that kind of thing, recipe photographs, and testing them out at home.
Yeah, I would just pick ones that looked kind of crazy to me and ones that looked like I could never do it,
uh-huh.
You know?
And what happened?
Well, the very next one I did was this orange plunta cake, and I didn't have ground almonds. I didn't have orange flower water, but I made it. Like, it came out, and it wasn't what I expected. It was delicious. And so then I was kind of like, well, I guess I'll keep doing this. Even though I expected a lot of failures.
And you didn't end up getting failures?
I definitely have a lot of failures, but but more successes for sure.
So, Amelia, you were looking for how the food tastes, or were you looking at, does it look like what it looked like in the magazine, or both?
Definitely both. Not only did I want it to be delicious, but I wanted it to be a beautiful post.
Well, you know, maybe you can do a public service here, because were there consistent failures with, you know, either certain magazines or certain
people?
Yes. And
oh, yes.
Would you name names? As I said, this is for public service.
I'd say Gourmet consistently delivered. I did a little tribute to it when they closed. And I've got to say Martha Stewart, I just can't get her down. I just have trouble with her.
Uh-huh. And Bon Appetit and Savour, where do they sit?
Bon Appetit is great. They're kind of, they're always delicious. I just think sometimes Well, I don't know. They're pretty challenging. Sevres is beautiful. I want to start doing a lot more from Sevres. I feel like they're kind of my new gourmet. So.
Hey, Amelia, thanks so much for talking with us.
No, thank you. It was my pleasure.
Amelia Morris's blog is Bon Appetemps. And that is our show this week. Thanks for joining us. Remember, you can call us anytime. The number is 800-537-5252. You have a great week, and let me leave you with this thought from P.J. O'Rourke, who said, "Veal is a very young beef, and like a very young girlfriend, it's cute, but boring and expensive." Splendid Table is produced by American Public Media. Now, you're going to find information on nearly everything you heard here today on our website, splendidtable.org. Also at splendidtable.org is the Splendid Table store, where you can find products related to cooking and baking. Our show is produced by Jennifer Russell with help from Jennifer Larson and Mary Beth Leone Gettin. Our editor and technical director is Jennifer Lubke. The website is managed by Sarah Lear. Our managing producer is Sally Swift. We're going to be back next week. You have a great one, and thanks for tuning in. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is APM, American Public Media. American Public Media.